Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here for our second case on today's calendar. It's A241511, La Palme versus Auto Owners Insurance Company. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal for the appellant. I'd ask that you each state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking, and let us know how we can reference you this morning. These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted today. And the podium moves up and down with a little button on the lower right, if I'm correct. And with that, counsel, whenever you're ready, we're ready for you.
My name is Bill Yang, B-I-L-L-Y-A-N-G, for the appellants Andrew and Jennifer LaPalme. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. We're here today to ask this court to reverse the motion to dismiss granted by the district court for two reasons. First, the one-year notice of loss provision in the LaPalme's homeowner policy when they suffered hail damage is not a condition precedent to coverage, or at the very least, it was ambiguous as to whether or not it was. The Minnesota law is clear that when the notice of loss provision is not a condition precedent, insurers must show actual prejudice. That is, any delay actually prejudiced their ability to investigate the claims, which auto owners have not alleged here or at the district court. Secondly, in the alternate, even if this court is to believe that the notice of loss provision was unambiguously a condition precedent, it was objectively impossible for anyone in the LaPalme's shoes to have detected the damage to their house. Therefore, the court should not forfeit the LaPalme's otherwise vested rights simply because it was impossible for them to comply with an otherwise minor and technical provision.
Counsel, to determine whether the provision in the insurance contract is ambiguous, we would have to identify more than one reasonable interpretation associated with the language in the contract. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the alternate reasonable interpretation of the contract?
So there are two. So to be specific, the thing that we are trying to determine is if it's ambiguous or not is whether or not it was a condition precedent. So there is simply two.
I'm aware. I want to know what the. How are we interpret? What are the reasonable interpretations of the language in the contract?
There are two reasonable interpretations that in alternate we argue. One is that it is not a condition, that language is merely a ordinary obligation and not a condition. The other one is the one that respondents have put forward, which is that it is.
So how do we get to your alternate reasonable interpretation based on the language that's in the contract?
Yes, Your Honor. The policy here, so to begin with, we can note that condition precedents must be clear and unequivocally expressed as held by this court. That means that it must be clear and unequivocal that auto owners meant to condition their coverage upon the LaPalme's providing the one-year notice of loss. So the language in this clause reads, notice of the loss or damage must be given to auto owners within 1 year after the date the loss or damage occurred. Full stop. So in that language, there is simply, our first argument is that there is only one reasonable interpretation and that is not a condition precedent. There is no conditioning the fact that auto owners' performance of coverage is dependent on them on the LaPalme's being within that one-year time span.
Would you be able to make that argument with the same force if immediately preceding the notice provision was the statement, we agree to provide insurance subject to all terms and conditions of this policy? In the immediately preceding sentence to the notice sentence, would you still have the same argument?
Yes, Your Honor is concerned about the suit immunity clause here.
Not the suit immunity clause. This is at the outset of the policy, and this didn't get as much emphasis. It's mentioned in respondent's brief. Most of it is focused on the suit immunity clause that you just referred to. This is the kind of catch-all statement at the beginning of the the policy, or I'm looking on page 9 of respondents' addendum in the homeowners policy form 3 insuring agreement. And the whole sentence reads, in reliance upon your statements and the declarations and applications, we agree to provide insurance subject to all terms and conditions of this policy. So what I'm wondering is, if that sentence was placed immediately above the notice provision, would you still be able to argue that the notice provision is ambiguous and is not a condition precedent?
That could, in theory, make it a weaker case. However, the Minnesota Supreme Court has been quite clear that the addition of such limiting language elsewhere in the policy, without it being part of that provision itself, has very limited effect on transforming the provision into a condition precedent.
So how do we reconcile that with cases like, the nearly 200-year-old case of Bolin, where we have to read the policy together? And that's pretty standard, for any contract interpretation, that we have to read the contract or the policy as a whole. So I understand that, this was not written with that sentence immediately before the notice provision, but we still have to read the whole policy, right? And if that's in the policy, why doesn't that convert the notice provision into a condition precedent?
So there are two reasons. As a preliminary matter, it should be noted that in the Minnesota Supreme Court in Nath Brothers v. American National Fire has already noted that the Bolin and Shapiro interpretation, in that case it was a 60-day notice of loss, submission of proof in a fire loss, is no longer a condition precedent. In Minnesota law, that provision is quite clearly a condition subsequent, which just means that the insured must provide that notice before the insurers pay the check, but not as a determinant of its liability. But to the other point, the other reason is that that it's a standard principle in insurance interpretation that contracts are read from the ordinary plain meaning as understood by the average insured. Insurance contracts are contracts of adhesion, and these contracts need to be quite clear. So we can compare, for instance, in the language in, for instance, Nath Brothers Court, there was a similar language that says, we shall not be sued. It has operatively the same effect that respondents have claimed as the in-return clause. They cited them together in the same sort of section in their brief, and they argue that read together, that creates it. However, the Nath Brothers Court had explicitly foreclosed that line of argument. We've noted this in our reply brief, but the holding in Nath Brothers is quite clear, that the addition, quote, the addition of a maintenance of suit clause to the fire insurance policy did not make strict compliance with all its terms a condition precedent to recovery. That is from the Nath Brothers Court explicitly.
So what do you do about the citation of supplemental authority to Engle? That came after your reply, so I want to make sure you respond to that, because that takes a plain reading of the policy taken as a whole and might be seen as somewhat of a repudiation of the view you want us to take of Nathie.
So to be clear, the Engle case was talking about whether or not, in that case, there was a statutory template and whether or not the language in the policy that had minor changes from the standard statutory language made it ambiguous as to whether or not they had to provide it strictly within 6 months. Now, we're not saying that the notice of loss provision is strictly, like the one-year provision part is ambiguous. The Engle court did not analyze the conditional element at all. It was not a case about condition precedent. The plaintiffs in that case were arguing that the deadline that they had was ambiguous, which is not what we're arguing here. We're not contesting that there was any ambiguity to the one-year part. We're arguing that the whole provision read together does not contain conditional language, which the Engle court did not address.
When you think about the application of an insurance contract, the insurance company has to be something to tell the insurance company that it needs to do something, right? And so that thing is, I'm telling you that I want you to do something. There's been a loss that's occurred that's covered by my policy. So how is the insurance company to know that something has happened that would trigger its obligations in the absence of notice from the insured?
So there are two elements to this notice provision. And one is the very fact of the notice. And we're not contesting that that is important before the insurance company has to pay. We're talking about the one-year deadline. So, again, auto owners has not contested.
And how are they divorced from each other?
So the very fact of providing the notice is important, but that is not being contested here. Auto owners is not saying they don't currently have the notice. The key here is whether or not that compliance strictly with 1 year. So 1 year plus 1 second, whether that part was also a condition precedent.
And I don't understand how we can slice those two concepts from each other, given that the insurer is not obligated to do anything until it's notified of a loss, which I think you're not contesting.
We're not contesting that, you know, they could be.
So why is it that the timing of the notice can be divorced from the fact of the notice? The requirement of the timing can be divorced from the requirement of the fact of notice. How is that possible?
So actually in the Minnesota Supreme Court in Sterling State Bank v. Virginia Surety, the Supreme Court has specifically noted that there's two things, first of all, the fact of notification and the manner. And that court specifically said the fact of notification is far more important than the manner of notification. So without clear conditioning the manner of notification as well onto coverage, the mere fact is separate from the manner in which it is delivered.
But isn't the timing the fact of notification? I mean, when we're talking about the manner of notification, we're talking written or to a specific address or something like that. When we're talking about the fact of notification, it's, I got to tell you, that you have to do something.
No, Your Honor, that's actually sort of, you've actually set the exact distinction. The fact that we tell you is the fact of notification. Within 1 year is one of the manners of notification.
But isn't I'm sorry.
Yeah, what's the authority for that proposition?
In Sterling State Bank, they for instance, note the fact and manner, and that case was about whether or not there was a delay. In, for instance, in Reliance Insurance and Nath Brothers, there is a separation of the idea of...
In those cases, it said that timing was manner of notification?
They don't explicitly say that, Your Honor. Okay. However, they do know.
Is there a case that does say that?
Not in those exact words, Your Honor, but it is in the spirit of the law that otherwise, for instance, in the Reliance case and Nath Brothers, they both note that, for instance, providing notice was important, but then they go on to analyze the timing. So in Reliance Insurance, there was an 18-month delay. In Nath Brothers, there was something... I can't remember the exact, but a couple months of delay as well, both exceeding the period there. So those courts implicitly had separated the delay and the timing of it from the mere fact of notice.
But doesn't the fact of notice become meaningless if there, I mean, you have to pick some arbitrary point in time by which, I mean, if you're going to have a notice provision, it's, I mean, what your counterpart argues is that the reason why it's important to have notice in a year, from their perspective, is to distinguish between hail loss, damage caused by hail, and damage caused by weathering, for example. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, doesn't notice, the fact of notice become meaningless if there is no time element of when notice is given?
We're not arguing, of course, that all delay all the time is going to be all right, but this is exactly why the rule is what it is in Minnesota, actual prejudice. So in Your Honor's hypothetical there, if there was, for instance, weather that obfuscated the initial hail damage, that would be a prejudice upon auto owners' ability to investigate the loss.
Okay, and I just because your time is running out, and I know they haven't argued prejudice, I just wanted to skip you forward to impossibility, and I wanted to ask you for your objectively impossible argument. Let's presume that the homeowners in this case happen to be roofers or contractors that had expertise in identifying hail damage. Would it not be objectively impossible for them, because of their particular expertise, to determine that a loss had occurred?
Yes, Your Honor. In that case, it would be you would have to factor that in as one of the another person stepping into their shoes, and those shoes might contain expertise, but they do not have that here.
But why doesn't that, if you're agreeing with that hypothetical, why doesn't that render what you've offered us subjective impossibility, because it just depends on the individual's particular expertise. I mean, it's not impossible for all people is what I understand the impossibility rule to require, right? I mean, so if it's not impossible for all people to comply with the condition precedent, then why is it objectively impossible?
So objective standards still has to be putting somebody into the shoes. So it still has to consider, for instance, the facts of the case here. We're saying not just that the LaPalms can submit a testimony and say, subjectively, we had no idea, and that's the end of the story. Rather, that anyone, given these facts, given as the objective facts are alleged, had no way of knowing. So obviously, if the LaPalms were roofers, that is a different story, but objective standards have always considered the facts around the circumstances. I see my time has elapsed. We're asking this court to reverse the motion to dismiss granted by the district court.
Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court and good morning. My name is Jeff Markowitz and I represent the respondent, Auto Owners Insurance Company. Auto Owners respectfully ask the court to affirm the dismissal of the complaint. Three plain terms in this insurance policy, read as a whole, make clear to a reasonable insured and reasonable people that providing notice within 1 year of a hail loss or damage is a condition precedent to hail coverage. First, as Judge Eade pointed out, as soon as you start reading this policy in the umbrella clause, subject to, the insurance being promised is subject to all terms and conditions in the policy, and in return, the insured must comply with all of those terms and conditions. Second, both lists of conditions set out prominently under suit against us, we may not be sued unless there is full compliance with all of the terms. And lastly, of course, must, notice must be given within a year of the hail occurrence. Ordinary contract principles generally apply to insurance policies, and ordinary contract principles say this policy is unambiguous. There is no alternative reasonable interpretation. And our supplemental citation to Engel is at least very instructive given its reference to a not be sued clause as applied to a notice term.
Is there some question of fact as to whether, I mean, it's not entirely clear to me from looking at the record, which is sparse in this case, but is there some question of fact as to what caused the loss in this case? Or does everyone concede that it was the hail event that occurred more than 1 year before notice was provided?
There is certainly a question of fact on causation. We're not conceding on causation. It's not material to this decision, to the order of the district court or this appeal. But all we have at this point is an allegation that a contractor says that hail loss was the cause.
And is it because they've identified the event occurring more than 1 year before notice was provided that as the event causing the loss, that you just said that that's just not allowed under the contract?
No, there's two pieces here, if I understand the question correctly. Auto Owners acknowledges that there were hailstorms around that time. As for causation, we simply have what the contractor allegedly told the LaPalms is the cause, and that's hail damage is the cause. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, there's a provision, this is on your addendum, it goes from page 33 to 34, it's under general conditions and valuation. So it's under paren B, subparen 2. If you decide not to repair or replace the lost or damaged covered property, we will pay no more than the actual cash value of the property at the time of loss. If you do, you may make a further claim for any additional payment on a replacement cost basis provided you notify us of your intent to repair or replace the lost or damaged covered property within 180 days after the initial actual cash value payment. So that last sentence that I read seems to be kind of the prototypical example of using those, we don't use magic words, but very much preferred words for conditions precedent, right? We have the provided in there and the if starting it. So my question for you is, this is a clear example of your client knowing how to draft a condition precedent. If we agree with you that the we may not be sued clause and the umbrella clause essentially convert all of the terms, you know, this is one of the concerns that the appellants raise, all the terms of the policy into conditions precedent, why would your client needed to have drafted it this way? Aren't we reading this into surplusage? Couldn't they have just said, you must notify of us of your intent to repair or replace the loss or damage covered property within 100 days after the initial actual cash value payment to make a further claim for any additional? Because that would mirror the notice provision, right? If we use must in that formulation. So, you know, this is kind of that classic legislative interpretation, contract interpretation of you're showing you know how to do it in one situation, and we don't want to read anything as surplusage. So tell me why you should prevail given this kind of conflict.
One of the megaphoned messages that courts send to insurance companies is you need to speak as plainly and clearly as possible. And there's a lot that goes into those considerations. And one of the things that works contrary to plain speaking is length and more words. As this court recognized in Engle, there were simple directive terms in terms of notice. They didn't even use the word must, and this court acknowledged that using must would be a clearer directive. But still, the simplicity of the language was important. It's a simple directive. Adding more words, which would be duplicative of the umbrella clause and the we may not be sued clause, also impacts readability. If we want insured...
Duplicative here? I mean, in what I just read you, it seems very duplicative of the we may not be sued clause and the...
I think that plain speaking with the clause that Your Honor cited is favored by the use of that language there. When looking to what should you do in case of loss, and that's the goal of that section, I think plain speaking is simple, direct language saying what the insured must do and not busying it up with if-then clauses when already you've done two catch-all clauses, one being the first thing an insured would read, and the second being what the insured would read if they looked through the conditions. I think adding the additional words is not what would be required and also would actually be contrary to facilitating plain, simple reading.
So I take it your answer is no, but you don't think that this introduces some ambiguity to the policy given that this language wasn't used in the notice provision but was used in this actual cash value provision?
I don't think that suspenders make belts ambiguous. I think just because there's additional language there that provides clarity in one way does not mean that a reasonable insured would not see the word must and understand that must means must and failure to do a must has consequences. And we're not just relying on the must. The must has the umbrella and the other clause. To the extent that there was a readability benefit to the drafting, I can't speak too much to what the intent was there, but it doesn't call into doubt the intent as do other provisions when subject to and unless are used in two separate general conditioned precedent language. It's not about converting every obligation. It's just making clear what the intent of the parties, what the intent of the policy is.
Let me just ask you one other way of asking this question.
Certainly.
So if the policy did not contain the umbrella clause and the we must... you know, the suit limitation clause, would you lose just based on the must language?
I think we would have a much harder time. Generally, I have not seen any case that has said that must alone or a should or an imperative is a condition precedent. I do think, though, that if we're going to give reasonable interpretation to must, I'm not sure what else must could mean other than, and if you don't, your coverage claim can be denied. This court was actually faced in Engle with an ambiguity argument that the clause was ambiguous because it didn't say what the consequences were of not providing notice. That was the first thing that the court wrote in the analysis section. And the court did have a we may not be sued clause, but I think even without it, there would be at least a reasonable argument that must alone is sufficient, but we don't need to go that far. And I honestly don't see what the alternative meaning would be, because you would need two reasonable interpretations. One reasonable interpretation of must is that if you don't do it, then your claim is denied. Then if there's a consequence, I can't imagine what any other reasonable consequence would be.
What they argued was that you're not going to get your claim paid until you've given the notice, but not that you can't file suit or not. I mean, that's how I understood them to frame that.
But that would not be a reasonable interpretation. If the requirement is you must provide notice within a year. If someone provides a notice after a year, I don't see how must means must. Must means we encourage. Must means something else. To give real meaning to must, I don't see an alternative reasonable interpretation that means your claim could be sustained, your claim could succeed.
Can I just explore with you a potential alternative reasonable interpretation of the clause that doesn't focus on the word must?
Certainly.
So we have a situation here, which I think is not atypical for homeowners, where they did not realize that there was an event that caused some damage that might be covered by the policy, assuming that all of the conditions of the policy are met. And that's probably because the roof is high up and you can't necessarily see everything that's on the roof on a day-to-day basis. It's not like a water pipe bursts in your house and you realize, oh no, I've got water everywhere in my house, which is usually a covered event too. So why isn't it reasonable when we are construing these contracts against the insurance company as the drafter here? Why isn't it reasonable to consider the date that the homeowner learns of the loss as the triggering event that would start the clock ticking? Like, oh, now I realize that there has been some damage to the shingles of my roof, and that damage could probably be traced to this event that occurred, but I didn't have any idea that it caused, that event caused this loss. Now that I know that, my clock starts ticking, and now I get to tell the insurance company, and it's covered. Why isn't that a reasonable interpretation of this contract?
Three responses. First, just as background, it's a year term, and I think that's really important just for the context that we're operating in. I've tried to cover the waterfront with my review, my prep for today, reviewing the cases. Frequently, the lengths are never longer than 60 days. One example of 6 months is Engel. Usually, it's immediately or as soon as practical and no more than 60 days. A year is a very long time. But as for two direct responses, first, that's a discovery rule. That is rewriting a policy which is directly contrary to what the Minnesota Supreme Court said should happen in Sterling. Yes, we have these favorable readings we give to insureds, but we cannot rewrite unambiguous policy language. And the second is that would be a very different policy. The Winthrop decisions from the District of Minnesota and then going on to a circuit distinguishes between claims made and occurrence policies. That's a radically different policy, and it would transform occurrence policies into claims made policies.
I'm wondering if you wanted to respond to the second impossibility exception argument that appellants make in their reply brief regarding just setting aside the objective subjective issue, but whether it's a technicality and it's resulting in a forfeiture.
Two responses broadly. One, that would effectively require an expansion of the disproportionate forfeiture exception that the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized in a very limited sense in Capsatrant, where it says both it's limiting its recognition to the unique circumstances of the case, and then in a footnote, we are not deciding whether to recognize this exception outside of those circumstances, which was an employment case involving unpaid commissions, and it was not an insurance case. And this court, not cited in the briefing in Athena 2004, expressly recognized that that case does not go into other contexts. And two, that really matters. I think one reason that the Minnesota Supreme Court stopped short of going that far, I have a third point. I think one reason the Supreme Court stopped short of going that far is that really upsets contractual expectations. I think a full-fledged disproportionate forfeiture exception that calls on courts to evaluate on the back end whether terms were material or not and whether they're going to enforce them introduces a great deal of uncertainty. But third, it is material. A year A year is a really long time. It is a favorable, generous length of time that I think is unmatched in any other notice period that generally applies. And the Minnesota legislature itself presumptively found that length presumptively reasonable in the standard HARE policy, saying a year is the presumptive length that insureds should be allowed to sue after the occurrence occurs. And while this policy allows 2 years to sue, it puts the notice requirement at 1 year. To conclude that is not, it's certainly presumptively reasonable, but it's also very important for meaningful investigation to occur, as I think one of your honors pointed out from our briefing.
Does it matter for considering the technicality point that this was very close to a year, that it was just in June and, you know, the year period ran in May, or is the technicality assessment, setting aside everything you said about us not expanding the law in the way the Supreme Court, you've argued, has foreclosed, is a technicality done really very objectively, not based on the specific facts of the case?
When you look at the technicality escape hatch language that's cited from the out-of-state case law in the reply brief, you see those are courts that take a little bit more of a dismissive take towards clear, plain language. Brakeman is one of the decisions that actually says we don't give language we don't literally interpret language in insurance contracts apart from that. Could you restate your question? I'm so sorry.
I'm just saying, can we consider in deciding whether it's a technicality that this was very close to a year?
I don't think that's the right starting point, because it's how long from the occurrence. The fact that an insurance company gives a wide berth to a notice provision, shouldn't it count against it when someone actually violates that plain term that was stated in must imperative terms and in the context of two conditions precedent of overarching terms, subject to and unless? I thank your honors for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to respond to 2 points that respondents have made here. First, they've argued that the word must, that there is no reasonable alternative interpretation of that language other than as a condition precedent to coverage. I'll just quote, so there are 2 cases held by the Minnesota Supreme Court where the policy in that question were not condition precedents. So the first one is Reliance Insurance v. St. Paul Insurance. The policy in that language, as the opinion states, reads, as soon as practicable, notice must be given to the company, et cetera, et cetera. In Nate Brothers in 2000, the Minnesota Supreme Court's policy language there read, in case of any loss, under this policy, the insured shall give immediate written notice. As a reminder, the policy here reads, notice must be given to the insurer, must be given to auto owners within 1 year after the date of loss. Those are virtually identical language. The Reliance Insurance case contains the word must. The Nate Brothers case contains the word shall. In both cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that those provisions were not condition precedents.
I mean, but the surrounding language is very different. I mean, as soon as practicable is not the same as you must give notice within 1 year.
No, Your Honor, there is a difference in the time scale, but the respondents have argued that the word must there is operative, and it is simply not. It has not been the operative word in the Minnesota Supreme Court precedents in this case.
Does it matter for Nathie Brothers that the language was no suit shall be sustained or claim shall be sustainable versus the provision here that says we may not be sued? Is there, or is that?
No, Your Honor. The cases that respondents have cited, Bolin and Shapiro, contain the same exact language, or almost the exact same language as Nate Brothers, something like no suit shall be sustained. And so I think the parties relatively agree that they are materially similar suit maintenance clauses. Again, it's not just Nate Brothers. In McCullough v. Travelers Insurance Company, the Supreme Court once again held that the maintenance of suit clause, same exact language there, did not transform the notice of loss provision afterwards. So it is simply just not Minnesota Supreme Court precedents that the addition of the maintenance of suit clause has any material impact in transforming the provisions afterwards. Now, to look at a couple of cases that respondents have cited where they have where the Supreme Court had held it, that there was a condition in Sterling State Bank.
Can I just bring you all the way back to how this contract operates? I mean, it is a bilateral contract. The insurer is obligated to do something, and the insured is obligated to do something. You'd agree with that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the insured required to do before the insurer has an obligation to fulfill its obligation under the contract?
They have a number of obligations, such as not worsening the conditions and submitting the notice within 1 year, but subject...
They have an obligation to submit a notice within 1 year.
But subject to the actual... So any delay is subject still to the actual prejudice showing. So that rule operates if there is a delay. If, for instance, the palm submitted within 1 year, but there was some prejudice, the law looks completely different. I don't want to generalize there, but it looks completely different. So it is subject to still the rule set by the Minnesota Supreme Court that there must be actual showing of prejudice after a delay. And finally, I'd just like to point out that at the very least, the language when read together, combined with the Minnesota Supreme Court precedents, there are at least two interpretations of the notice of loss provision as to whether or not it was a condition. Again, in that ambiguity, by that standard, ambiguities are resolved in favor of the insured. Under the doctrine of contra preferentum, these ambiguities, Judge Eade noted, the ambiguity can easily be written away, and they have done so in numerous parts of the policy. In Sterling State Bank, that notice of loss provision was under a section called conditions. They cite a couple of other cases, Michaels v. First USA Title. The insured shall, as a condition precedent to the availability of rights under the policy, give written notice. The insurance knows how to create condition precedents. They've deliberately chosen not to do so here. It is clear and unambiguous that it is not a condition precedent. Therefore, we're asking this court to reverse the motion to dismiss granted by the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you very much for your submissions and your arguments today. They were very helpful to the court. I understand it was your first argument. Well done. Well done, both counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement, issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And we'll take a short recess while we reset to reconvene the panel. Thank you.